Okay, so this is Bio 241, and it's May 11th, and we're going to finish up urinary system today. And let's see, you have a final next time, Wednesday, and it's going to be over the second cardiac chapter, so cardiac output, blood pressure, blood volume, respiratory system, urinary system. So just three chapters, your study guides are online, and I'm getting most of the lectures online, but I couldn't upload them over the weekend for some reason. Hopefully it will come back to where I can upload today's lecture tonight. Yeah. The final? You know, I don't have that information on me. I should have brought the schedule. It might be 3:30 to 5:30. Yeah, I think it's 3:30 to 5:30. So there's usually a half-hour break between classes. So if you get here at 3, you probably can get in the room anyway. Okay. Okay, so I think we were around this point last time. All right, autoregulation of the kidneys. And this is an intrinsic mechanism as opposed to extrinsic. That would be due to what? Sympathetic effects. So extrinsic just means that there's going to be some regulation coming from outside the kidney, namely the sympathetic nervous system that causes vasoconstriction of afferent arterioles, which is going to reduce glomerular filtration. And if the glomerulus isn't filtering as much, then that reduces urine production, okay, and that increases blood volume, for instance. So that's going to counteract the initial stimulus that we see right here involving even the baroreceptor reflex of decreased blood pressure. All right, so this is an extrinsic mechanism. Intrinsic, okay, just helps the kidneys maintain relatively constant filtration rate in the face of fluctuating blood pressure. So a person's blood pressure can go up and down, and blood pressure is going to affect blood flow through the glomerulus and therefore affect the filtration rate, but that's not necessarily what your body needs or wants. So in order to adjust for fluctuations in blood pressure while keeping GFR the same, then there has to be vasoconstriction or vasodilation of the afferent arteriole, right, which works in a way to counteract the change in blood pressure. So if there's an increase in blood pressure, which means glomerular filtration will increase, then the afferent arteriole should constrict to reduce some flow. All right, so there are two kinds of intrinsic regulation. There's a myogenic response or myogenic constriction of the afferent arteriole due to smooth muscle responding directly to an increase in blood pressure. So that's going to cut the flow back to where it should be to maintain GFR exactly the same. And the second is what we call tubuloglomerular feedback. And this is achieved via effects locally produced by chemicals that act on the afferent arterioles. So, for instance, if there is high flow through the distal convoluted tubule and signifying what? A high glomerular filtration rate, then this is going to cause constriction of the afferent arterioles. So here's a pretty good table that shows sympathetic activity versus autoregulation. So what would you consider sympathetic, intrinsic or extrinsic?
Extrinsic.
That's extrinsic, and then autoregulation is intrinsic. So here are two intrinsic mechanisms. All right, so sympathetic nerves activated by the baroreceptor reflex or even higher brain centers can constrict the afferent arteriole, and that decreases glomerular filtration to maintain blood pressure, right, to restrict urine formation. And then autoregulation, a decrease in blood pressure is going to cause dilation. Okay, so no change, and this is what we want. We don't want a change in glomerular filtration rate with a change in blood pressure. But if there's an increase in blood pressure, this is going to cause constriction to keep the flow through the glomerulus the same, and so no change in glomerular filtration rate. Okay. All right, so what is controlling the tubular glomerular feedback is just the volume of filtrate, just the volume of filtrate passing through the distal convoluted tubule, right past the juxtaglomerular apparatus, right? And that's what we call tubular glomerular feedback. An increase in flow of filtrate sensed by the macula densa, right? That's part of the juxtaglomerular apparatus. It signals the afferent arterioles to constrict, which is going to reduce glomerular filtration. Okay, so let's talk about resorption of salt and water. The proximal convoluted tubule, you have a picture where the proximal convoluted tubule is, that's the segment coming right out of the glomerulus, right? Returns most molecules like sodium and potassium, as well as water, from filtrate back into the peritubular capillaries. All right, so we said that there was about 20% of the plasma gets filtered by the glomerulus, and we can't afford to lose that much fluid. And as a matter of fact, how many gallons is that every day? Well, that's not on this slide. That's about what? 45 gallons, right? So your body has to resorb most of it. It's mostly resorbed in the proximal convoluted tubule. So about 180 liters a day of filtrate produced, only 1 to 2 liters of urine are excreted in 24 hours. So most of the fluid is resorbed in the proximal convoluted tubule. And we're going to see how that happens. All right? But of course, the urine volume varies according to the body's needs. If you're dehydrated, you'll secrete less. If you're well hydrated, you'll excrete a lot more. But you do need a minimum of about 400 milliliters a day of urine production just to excrete the metabolic wastes that our body produces, and that's what we call the obligatory water loss. So no matter what your hydration state is, even if you're dehydrated, you need to excrete that much water to get rid of metabolic wastes. Okay, so the transport of molecules out of the proximal convoluted tubule, right, and put back in the blood is what we call tubular reabsorption. All right, water is never transported out, but other molecules are transported out via active mechanisms, right? And then water just follows by osmosis. So, right, if we increase the osmolality of the fluid outside of this tubule, can you see that water just passively will move through this membrane to dilute those solutes that are in high concentration right here? All right, so that's how the proximal convoluted tubule works. So let's look at how salt and glucose is absorbed. And this actually is a review of an illustration that you had on a previous exam. All right, so there is coupled transport of sodium and glucose from the proximal convoluted tubule back in the blood. So here we have in the apical surface of a kidney tubule cell. Here is the basolateral surface. And we have different transporters in the different membranes. So here is a co-transporter, right, moving glucose from low concentration to high concentration inside the cell. So what's the energy that's being used to move glucose from low concentration in the kidney filtrate into this cell right here? It's using the form of energy in terms of the gradient of sodium, right? So sodium wants to enter this cell. This is a proximal tubule cell. Because of a concentration gradient, and this is a coupled transport, so we call this a co-transporter. So when sodium, the energy in sodium can be used to transport glucose across the cell membrane. So even if there's very low concentrations of glucose in the filtrate, it should all be resorbed in the proximal convoluted tubule. All right, and in the healthy individual, it certainly is. All right, and then it's high concentration inside the cell, low concentration in this space outside the nephron, interstitial space, and then of course glucose can go from high concentration to low just passively as long as there's a transporter. All right, so here is a little facilitated transporter carrier that allows glucose to move across the membrane. So why can't glucose move across the membrane without facilitated diffusion transporter? Because, oh, you're forgetting your physical chemistry. I'm concerned. Okay, it's because what? Glucose is a polar molecule and can't go across the membrane by itself, right? Okay. So it needs help. Sodium, on the other hand, all right, needs this sodium-potassium pump. And remember that this is just an exchanger. Potassium will be pumped into the cell. Sodium will be pumped out, and then sodium can go from high concentration to low to get into the blood as well as glucose right here. All right, so that's the mechanism by which glucose and sodium is resorbed by the proximal convoluted tubule. All right, so you might have to review that diagram. I'm not too sure. Okay, so the proximal convoluted tubule is not regulated. It's constantly working as fast as it can to resorb chloride and sodium. All right, and so it just works at a constant level all the time. Can't be adjusted by hormones or whatever. Okay, but don't forget that just water follows by osmosis according to the concentration gradient. All right, so this process of plasma going into Bowman's capsule is what we call filtration. That's passive. The reabsorption of sodium and chloride is passive, and water is passive as well in the proximal convoluted tubule. So about 65% of the sodium and chloride and water that is filtered gets resorbed in the proximal convoluted tubule and is returned to the bloodstream. All right, so 65% of what? The 45 gallons gets reabsorbed in the proximal convoluted tubule. All right, an additional 20%, so now we're up to 85%, is resorbed in the descending loop of Henle. And that's not regulated as well. That's just working full blast. So about 85% of the filtered water that's in the filtrate gets resorbed in the early segments of the nephron. Right? And so this is constant. It's not adjusted. It's independent of hydration levels. And this is pretty amazing. About 6% of your basal metabolic energy or calories is consumed, right, just for this resorption process. The remaining 15% of the water that's in the filtrate is resorbed varily depending on the state of hydration of your body. And of course, that happens in the distal convoluted tubule and the beginning parts of the collecting duct. So the proximal part of the collecting duct, where is the proximal part of the collecting duct at, as opposed to the distal part? What part of the kidney? That's in the cortical part, right? So we call that the cortical collecting duct because it's up in the cortex, that proximal part. So those can be adjusted. All right, so the collecting duct plays an important role in water conservation, okay? It is impermeable to salt. It's permeable to water, or its permeability to water depends on the level of antidiuretic hormone. So this is a controlling element for the nephron. All right, so as the osmolality of blood increases, that means dehydration. The hypothalamus has osmoreceptors. It increases the release of ADH. Oh, where does that ADH come from? It's not from the hypothalamus necessarily, but the hypothalamus, yeah, it's from the pituitary gland, and in particular the posterior pituitary. Aldosterone comes from the adrenal cortex. Yeah, aldosterone from the adrenal cortex. Okay, and of course, remember from the name, it's an antidiuretic, so that decreases urine volume, right? That increases water retention and decreases blood osmolality, so that has a negative effect on this initial stimulus. All right, and then the opposite would happen if osmolality of the blood decreased, right? So ADH secretion is decreased, that would increase water loss, effects on the blood, increase urine volume, so that would increase volume loss and would increase blood osmolality as a result. Okay, I'm not going to talk about atrial natriuretic hormone right at the moment. Okay, so here's a flow diagram that describes how antidiuretic hormone works, and antidiuretic hormone has got another name that people use, and it's called, anybody know what another name for antidiuretic hormone is? It's called vasopressin. So people use these terms interchangeably, I'm sorry to say, but once you kind of get it down, it's not such a big deal. Okay, so low water intake, like produced by dehydration, increases what? The saltiness of plasma, that increases plasma osmolality, that stimulates receptors in the hypothalamus. So this will help you remember the organs, okay, and not aldosterone, but osmoreceptors in the hypothalamus, then send signals to the posterior pituitary. How do those signals get to the posterior pituitary? Can you recall? Is it a neuronal circuit, or is it through a portal vessel? Okay. Now the anterior pituitary receives releasing hormones from the hypothalamus, but the posterior pituitary is more directly wired with a tract. So there is a nerve tract that goes from the hypothalamus to the posterior pituitary, and those tracts release antidiuretic hormone into capillaries of the posterior pituitary. So ADH increases, that since it's in the blood, it's a hormone, goes to the kidneys, that increases water resorption. All right, now why does that happen? Well, because ADH stimulates the insertion of special water channels into the plasma membranes of the collecting duct. So water can actually pass through the cell. So normally, collecting duct is impermeable to water. Water can't move from the filtrate into the blood, but when there's a signal, an ADH signal, these aquaporins, which are the water channels, get inserted into the plasma membranes, and this allows water to move by concentration gradient from the filtrate into the blood. All right, so when ADH is high, water is drawn out of the collecting duct by the high osmolality of the interstitial fluid, and then it's resorbed by the vasorecta. So the vasorecta is just a special name for the peritubular capillaries that are found deep in the medulla of the kidney. So these would be, for instance, the juxtamedullary nephrons that are specifically there to absorb a lot of water out of filtrate to make the filtrate very concentrated. So that's kind of the bottom line for the juxtamedullary nephrons, is to make very concentrated urine. Okay? All right, so that increased resorption, so this water goes into the blood, so there's less water excreted in the urine, and then this feeds back, what, in a nice negative sense, to the initial stimulus, which was a low water intake, right? And that brings water balance back and maintains homeostasis. All right, if on the other hand there's overhydration, decreased plasma osmolality, the osmoreceptors are going to decrease ADH secretion, and then the kidneys will then resorb less water, and it's going to make more production of urine, but dilute urine. So large quantities of dilute urine, and what is that going to do? That's going to feed back negatively to this overhydrated state. You're going to lose water as a result of that. Okay. All right, so here's a picture that's not in your book. All right, but I decided to give it to you and make it an exam figure. You don't have it in your PowerPoint slides, but it is in your exam study guide. Okay, so this shows exactly what we've been talking about. So we're talking about antidiuretic hormone. Another name for that is vasopressin, right? Vasopressin. So when vasopressin is released by, what organ releases vasopressin? That is the posterior pituitary, right? And that is a protein hormone. So where is the receptor for protein hormones at? So you can't forget your physical chemistry again, but it's coming back to you, all right? Because these proteins can't get across the cell membrane because they're polar compounds, so it's got to be a plasma membrane receptor. So indeed, here is the ADH receptor, and it works through cyclic AMP as a second messenger. So you've learned all these mechanisms, but you haven't really seen where they're found in the body. So I just really want to show you that you studied all that information for a good reason, because your body uses these things. All right, so cyclic AMP is a second messenger, which is coupled to a number of other mechanisms that then can take these endosomes that contain aquaporins, and it can insert these endosomes into the plasma membrane, and then what does that do? Well, that inserts these aquaporin pores into the apical membrane right here. All right, so when they're inserted, then water can move across the membrane. Without these aquaporins in the membrane, then water can't move across this membrane. All right, so that's the effect of antidiuretic hormone, and we're familiar with endosomes. What was another hormonal mechanism that was working by the insertion of certain kinds of transporters into the plasma membrane? Okay. What kind of, there was another really important molecule that can't go across the membrane, namely glucose. Okay. And there's a GLUT4 transporter that is stored in reserve in an endosome, And when there is an insulin signal, remember, and what kind of receptor is the insulin receptor? It's a tyrosine kinase, right? So it starts to phosphorylate tyrosine residues on regulatory proteins inside the cell, and then that would trigger the insertion of these GLUT4 transporters into the plasma membrane. So this is not a new kind of scheme for you to see. All right, so this is just the way that your body can respond in very quick fashion without having to build all of these water pores, all right, de novo. They're there, ready to go to work based on this vasopressin or ADH signal on the outside of the cell. All right, so then why does water move into the blood? Okay, well, what's the osmolality of filtrate at this point? It's 300. What's it inside this cell? Much higher. It's double. So which way is water going to go? It's going to go, yeah, from high concentration, where the osmolality is relatively low, right, to low concentration, where the osmolality is higher, right? So as long as there's a way to get in, and we put these aquaporin channels in, so water moves into the cell, okay? And then why does it move into the blood? Because in this part of the vasorecta, right, the blood is very concentrated. It's 700 milliosmolar. So water will diffuse into the blood as a result of that. But you've got to have these aquaporin channels there. Okay, and they're controlled by vasopressin. Okay, so hopefully this is a pretty easy scheme to show you. So here is what, the filtrate in the collecting duct. These are the collecting duct cells. Here's the medullary interstitial fluid. And then this is the plasma inside the peritubular capillaries that are deep inside the nephron, which are very concentrated, 700 milliosmolar. Okay, so that's how ADH works. Okay, plasma clearance. Alright? So secretion is the opposite of resorption. Alright, so I tell you what, let's just kind of write this down if I haven't done this already. Alright, we got the three basic processes where filtrate is produced and then processed into urine. All right. So what's the first process? Glomerular filtration. All right. So which way does material move for glomerular filtration? Which way is it going to go? What is going to move out of the circulatory system? So let's call that blood. So material is going to go from blood to, where's it going to go? I say filtrate. Sometimes your body calls it ultrafiltrate. But what is filtrate? It's a precursor to urine. It's a fluid that is going to be manipulated, and when it's done being adjusted, it will become urine. Right? But blood is, where do we find blood? In the nephron. Of the two kinds of places, you've got two different kinds of places in the nephron. You've got vascular elements that contain blood, and what contains filtrate? The tubular elements. Okay, so this stuff is going to move from blood to filtrate via glomerular filtration. And you should know where that is. Where is that taking place? Now, all about that. It takes place in the renal corpuscle, right? And there are holes in the capillary because they're leaky capillaries, right? We call those, it's a fenestrated capillary. And so the holes are fenestrations. So that happens within Bowman's capsule or the renal corpuscle. All right, the next thing, tubular reabsorption. Okay, why is that important? Well, because 45 gallons of plasma get filtered out of the glomerulus into the tubular elements of the nephron, and, well, you would dehydrate very quickly, within minutes, if that water wasn't put back in your circulatory system. Where does that happen? Mostly the proximal convoluted tubule. Okay, goes full bore doing that, and so when it goes the tubular reabsorption, which way does material move? What are the two kinds of fluids again in the nephron? You've got blood and filtrate. Okay, so when you reabsorb, which way do materials move? From filtrate back into the blood. Okay, and in the beginning part of the tubes of the nephron, 85% of whatever was filtered here gets put back in. So it's a huge return of fluid to the circulatory system, which is fantastic. All right, and but then there's one other process. All right, not all toxic materials are filtered. There's still some residual urea, for instance, maybe excess hydrogen ions, excess potassium, okay, that don't get filtered out, but your body needs to get rid of them. All right, and this is the third process. Tubular, what's the third process? Yeah, excretion and let's say secretion. Let's say secretion. Tubular secretion. Okay, and I'll show you what a lot of people like to use as a strict definition for excretion. It's a little bit particular, but it's okay with me. So which way does material move for tubular secretion? Filtrate to blood or blood to filtrate? It's going to go now the opposite way to reabsorption, so it's going to go blood to filtrate. Blood to filtrate. Okay, so that's what you see on this diagram right here. All right, so here is filtration in the glomerulus, blood to filtrate. In the proximal segments of the tubules, 85% of water is reabsorbed, so we call that tubular resorption, as well as sodium, and pretty much all the potassium that's in the filtrate is resorbed in the proximal tubule as well. All right, and then in the other segments of the nephron, there's tubular secretion right here for things that your body doesn't need, like excess potassium, excess hydrogen ions, urea, other toxic kinds of compounds. Okay, so... And then here is excretion. Excretion is actually what you're losing in urine. So it's a little bit different than secretion, okay? Okay, so how do you, what's the formula for clearance or excretion? So this material here is equal to the amount that's produced by filtration plus the amount that's produced by secretion minus what? Minus that's resorbed, right? So that's how you should think of excretion. It's filtration plus secretion minus reabsorption. Yeah.
So I'm going to say obviously in secretion, everything that is secreted is going to be excreted.
Yeah.
Secreted is just going out.
It's going out. Yeah, it's going out. Do I know any examples to the contrary? Nope. Okay, but even because that's so, you still can't say that secretion is equal to excretion because of filtration. And don't forget, this filtration is, that's 45 gallons a day going through all these nephrons, okay, a huge number. Okay, well, this is just what I said right here, okay, that's the excretion rate. So not all blood delivered to the glomerulus is filtered into the glomerular capsule. Right, 20% is filtered. The remainder passes into the efferent arteriole and back into the circulation. Right, substances that aren't filtered can still be cleared by active transport, which is what we call tubular secretion by the tubules. Okay. On the other hand, glucose and amino acids are normally 100% resorbed from the filtrate because glucose is a very important energy molecule that you make ATP out of. Right, you don't want to lose any glucose in the filtrate. So even if there's very low concentration of glucose in the filtrate, it can still go from low concentration to high concentration in the cells by what kind of process? How can you go from low concentration to high? Active transport, right? And we just showed you that slide, how glucose moves by what co-transport and then facilitated transport from the filtrate back into the peritubular capillaries. All right, and this mostly happens in the proximal convoluted tubule where glucose is transported with a co-transporter of that sodium molecule. All right, but now that transporter can display saturation. if the glucose concentration in the filtrate is too high, because you only have a certain number of transporters. And if they're all busy transporting glucose, if there's any extra above that level in the filtrate, well, then glucose will be lost in the urine. So that concentration or the rate of transport at where it reaches maximum is what we call the transport maximum, or TM. All right, so that's the level needed to saturate all those co-transporters. All right, then we're going to lose glucose in the urine. All right, so glucose and amino acid transporter don't saturate under normal conditions, okay, because glucose is controlled in your blood. It should never reach, right, over 200. Because if that's the case, all right, then what's the pancreas going to be doing as your blood glucose rises? Say 150, 160, 170, 180. It's going to release insulin, and then insulin is that passport, so cells can take up glucose, and then that drops your blood glucose level, always keeping it underneath the transport maximum in the kidney. But if for some reason, when somebody has diabetes mellitus for whatever reason, type 1 or type 2, the glucose concentration exceeds the transport maximum and can't be reabsorbed fully, and that's when somebody loses glucose in the urine. Okay? And so that's what we call the renal plasma threshold. That occurs between 180 and 200 milligrams per 100 ml of plasma. And that's what we call hyperglycemia, and it exceeds the renal threshold. It overwhelms all the transporters, and somebody will lose glucose in the urine, and that's what we call diabetes mellitus, and it produces that glycosuria. As a matter of fact, when somebody is a victim of diabetes mellitus and they don't control their diet, if there's a lot of sugar in their diet, there could be so much sugar in the urine that it actually crystallizes. You can actually see sugar crystals in somebody's urine when that happens. All right, so that's really a sad circumstance for that, because diabetes causes, uncontrolled diabetes causes all kinds of deleterious cardiovascular effects. It kills the heart, kills blood vessels, kills the kidneys, brain. Okay, and another very highly metabolic organ, retina. What do you need a retina for? Yeah, to see, right? So uncontrolled diabetes will produce blindness as well. Okay, so let's just talk about renal control of electrolytes, and I'm not going to get into acid-base balance, but we'll talk about electrolytes. All right, so the kidneys do control levels of sodium and potassium, hydrogen ion, bicarbonate, and chlorine, and even phosphate, by matching excretion in the urine to how much your intake is, your dietary intake. All right, so control of plasma sodium is important in regulation of blood volume and blood pressure. We've talked about that already. Okay, and control of plasma potassium is important for proper function of cardiac and skeletal muscles, as a matter of fact, even nerves, because how can you relate potassium to anything that a nerve or a muscle might be experiencing? How do we control muscle contraction? Or how do nerves work? They work by, like, resting membrane potential, and resting membrane potential is determined by potassium levels and sodium levels across the membrane. So if there's way too high potassium on the outside, what's that going to do to the membrane potential? That's going to hyperpolarize the membrane, and when the cell's membrane is hyperpolarized, what kind of stimulus do you need? You need a huge stimulus, right? So if potassium levels, extracellular potassium levels increase, you might not ever be able to reach a threshold. So muscle is not going to contract, nerve is not going to fire an action potential, okay? So that's really terrible when that happens. Okay, so the hormone mostly responsible for sodium and potassium balance is aldosterone. All right, so ADH is for water balance, but aldosterone for sodium and potassium. And what's it going to do for sodium, and what's it going to do for potassium? So if there's just one thing you're going to memorize that could help you maybe on a board exam sometime in your life, is that aldosterone. You'll have to take your board exam yourself, not me. Okay. So aldosterone is going to do what?
Retain sodium.
It's going to retain sodium, but what's the effect on potassium? it's going to be for secretion of potassium. So aldosterone is going to have opposite effects on sodium and potassium. All right, so if you ever see a question on a board exam, well, what hormone is important for sodium excretion but potassium retention, or potassium excretion and sodium retention? If you ever see anything in opposite for sodium and potassium, what are you going to say? Aldosterone, without even understanding what's going on, okay? But to kind of give you the short story for that, why is it opposite? Because you're familiar with the sodium-potassium pump. And so which way does the sodium-potassium work? In opposite directions. And so that's really the bottom line for why aldosterone does work the same way, okay? Because it's going to utilize that sodium-potassium pump. All right, so let me talk a little bit more, and then I'll show you some specific mechanism for that. All right, so 90% of the filtered sodium and potassium is resorbed before the distal tubules. As a matter of fact, you could say even 100% of the potassium is reabsorbed by the proximal convoluted tubule. All right, the remaining is variably reabsorbed in the distal tubules and collecting duct according to the body's needs, right? And that's going to be adjusted by aldosterone right here. So it's regulated by aldosterone. It controls potassium secretion and sodium resorption. So sodium is going to be reabsorbed by aldosterone. Right, in the absence of aldosterone, 80% of the remaining sodium is reabsorbed in the distal tubule and cortical collecting duct. Right, that's the proximal part of the collecting duct. When aldosterone is high, all the remaining sodium is resorbed. All right, so when there's no aldosterone, most of it's resorbed, but when there is an aldosterone signal, all of it's going to be resorbed, okay, to maintain blood volume and sodium. All right, so here's just a slide that shows the proximal tubule. All the potassium is resorbed. But if potassium is too high, this is the part of the nephron that's important for secreting potassium. And that's going to be under control of what hormone? Aldosterone, right? Okay, so under aldosterone stimulation, potassium is secreted into the cortical collecting ducts. Although this doesn't look like a collect, that almost looks like a distal convoluted tubule, but just pretend this is a collecting duct right here. Okay, so all the potassium that ends up in urine that is excreted is from secretion rather than filtration, because here all the potassium is reabsorbed. Yeah. Be dehydrated. You know, I don't know. Let me think about that. Uh-huh. And his potassium was really high? Ah, okay. Probably so, but I'd have to think about that. Okay? Yeah. Okay, let me work on that for a little bit. Okay, so what can you tell me about aldosterone? Where does it come from? It comes from the adrenal cortex. But the adrenal cortex is going to be signaled by, and you got to work backwards through the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism, right? So there's angiotensin 2 that's going to stimulate the adrenal cortex, and 2 comes from angiotensin 1, and angiotensin 1 comes from angiotensinogen, which is in your blood all the time, but it's converted by an enzyme from the kidney, namely renin. Okay. All right, so let's talk about the kidney, which gets this whole thing working. So here is the nephron. Here you can see the afferent arteriole, efferent arteriole, and then the proximal convoluted tubule, distal convoluted tubule. And the distal convoluted tubule passes right between the afferent and efferent arteriole at the entrance to Bowman's capsule. So let's just look right in this area right here. So here is the area, and this might remind you of anatomy a little bit. All right, so here is the thick ascending limb of the distal convoluted tubule. And these cells are specialized. This is the macula densa cells, and these are the juxtaglomerular cells. And we put both of these together, We call that the juxtaglomerular apparatus, and so sometimes these are called granular cells or JG cells. Okay, so these cells are going to monitor flow of filtrate, right, through the distal convoluted tubule, and that can help adjust glomerular filtration because these cells can help control constriction of the smooth muscle cells of the afferent arteriole. Okay, but there's something else too. All right. So this system, the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system, is activated by release of renin from the granular cells, right? It's from these cells right here, right? When? What happens? When there's a decrease in blood pressure. All right, so when there's a decrease in blood pressure, renin is released from the JG cells, and then renin is an enzyme in the blood that is going to convert angiotensinogen into 1, right, which is converted into 2 by ACE, angiotensin converting enzyme in the lungs, right? And angiotensin 2 stimulates release of aldosterone. And then aldosterone goes back to the kidney. And what is the effect of the kidney? Okay. So inadequate intake of sodium chloride always causes decreased blood volume. Okay, so you lose fluids when there's inadequate sodium chloride in your diet. And that's because lower osmolality of the blood inhibits antidiuretic hormone. Right? If you inhibit antidiuretic hormone, what's that like taking? A diuretic, so you're going to lose fluids, causing less water reabsorption. And that's where? That's in the distal convoluted tubule and collecting ducts because you're taking out those aquaporin water channels. So low blood volume and renal blood flow stimulate renin release. Okay, so renin release. So via direct effects of blood pressure on the granular cells and by sympathetic activity initiated by the baroreceptor reflex, right, renin can be released. So let's take a look at this graph right here that shows an interaction between antidiuretic hormone and aldosterone. All right, so low sodium intake, right, results in low plasma sodium concentration. And where can that be monitored? Osmoreceptors in the hypothalamus. All right, so low plasma concentration means that there is low osmolality, and the hypothalamus is going to signal the posterior pituitary to cut back on antidiuretic hormone, so it's going to cause a decrease in antidiuretic hormone. This will decrease water reabsorption in the collecting ducts, and when that happens, that increases urine volume, and that decreases blood volume. All right, that decreased blood volume is going to stimulate the baroreceptor reflex, right? Because what happens when blood volume decreases? What happens to blood pressure? That's an interesting step that's not on the slide. But when blood volume goes down, then cardiac output goes down because venous return is decreasing, so blood pressure decreases. So that stimulates the baroreceptor reflex, which increases sympathetic tone. There are nerves that go to the juxtaglomerular apparatus that causes the release of renin. Okay, because there's decreased blood pressure. What is this whole thing going to do? This is going to increase blood pressure, right? All right, so increase in renin produces angiotensin 2 via, we're leaving out a couple steps right here, right? But that interconverts angiotensinogen into angiotensin 1 and then into angiotensin 2, which goes to the adrenal cortex, stimulates an increase in aldosterone secretion, and that causes an increased resorption of sodium in the cortical collecting ducts, right? So this is not the proximal part of the nephron, this is the distal part of the nephron. Because the proximal part is always working at a constant level. It's these distal parts of the nephron that can be adjusted by either ADH or aldosterone. All right, so then aldosterone is going to increase sodium retention in the blood, and you can see that that subtracts from the initial stimulus, which is a low sodium intake. All right, so ADH and aldosterone work together, okay, to maintain proper levels of sodium in your body. Okay, so maybe to help you appreciate this system a little bit better, here is one last figure that's not in your book, all right, but this is an exam figure. And you don't have it in your PowerPoint slides, but you do have it in the study guide. Okay, so you have the key, you have the slide, and then you have all the important salient features erased from it. All right, and if you can't get to Blackboard, then you've got to see me after class and make sure you have the exam figures, right? Because these are really nice figures for you to know about, but they might also be on the exam. Yes.
So on Blackboard, we put down all the answers.
Yeah, the two key figures are there, as well as the figures that I possibly maybe would even put on the exam. Okay. I put it in. Yeah, I did put that. I put the key in color, but not the exam figure. Okay, because the exam figure is going to be black and white for you, but to understand the different compartments, sometimes it's helpful to see the different colors. At least I've been told. Okay, so what are the compartments we're looking at? Well, we're looking at filtrate inside the lumen of a distal tubule, right? So this is not the proximal tubule. And then we've got the cells of the distal tube nephron. And then we have the interstitial fluid, and then we have like the peritubular capillary right here, okay? Okay, so we're talking about what hormone? Aldosterone. Tell me something about aldosterone. And this is going to be physical chemistry again. So what do you know about aldosterone and physical chemistry?
Retain sodium.
Okay, it's going to retain sodium, but I want to know something about the physical properties of aldosterone. What kind of hormone is it? Okay, it's a steroid hormone. Since it's a steroid hormone, what can it do? It can go right across the plasma membrane because it's a lipid. It has lipid nature to it. So where are the receptors going to be for aldosterone? Are they going to be cytoplasmic or are they going to be on the plasma membrane? So since it can go through the plasma membrane, no sense having receptors there. It doesn't need a second messenger. It enters the cell directly. Okay. All right, so aldosterone moves by concentration gradient from the blood through the interstitial space into the cell, down its concentration gradient, where it binds to the aldosterone receptor. And this receptor, okay, can act as a transcription factor. What's transcription? It's the first step in something. It's the first step of protein synthesis. All right, so don't forget about your hormone control unit, hormone receptor activator units, right, can bind to DNA and initiate transcription. So what's the product of transcription? It's going to be messenger RNA, right? That's the first step of protein synthesis. What's the second step of protein synthesis? That RNA has to leave the nucleus and go into the cytoplasm where it's going to be translated. That's the second part of protein synthesis. So these genes are coding for channel proteins, right? Number one. And these channel proteins can be specifically for potassium channels or sodium channels, actually both of them as well. All right, these proteins are going to actually produce proteins that modulate these existing channels, maybe open them, for instance. Right? The third thing that these proteins made by transcription due to activation of this aldosterone receptor, right, is to also make sodium-potassium ATP pumps, right, and put them in the basolateral membrane. The channels are put in the apical membrane. All right, so the end result of aldosterone is that these channels are now open and there are more sodium-potassium ATP pumps. Which way do these work? Pumping sodium out of the cell, potassium into the cell, right? That I think you should be familiar with. Okay. All right, so that produces a low sodium inside the cell. This pump produces a low sodium inside the cell, so that means sodium can run down its concentration gradient through this channel right here. And this pump, right, increases sodium concentration inside blood. But in order for sodium to move into the blood, what about potassium? It's got to move the other way because of this pump. All right, so now we have secretion of potassium while sodium is resorbed as a result of this aldosterone signal. All right, so that's why I think bottom line, it might be pretty easy to remember the effect of aldosterone levels in your body. Okay, because these sodium potassium pumps are in what, the basolateral membrane, not the apical membrane. So it's pumping sodium into your body and pumping potassium out, right? So, I mean, the basic level of understanding, just go all the way back to your sodium-potassium pump. And aldosterone just allows this system to happen by inserting these sodium and potassium channels in the apical membrane right here. Okay? Okay, so this is, I think, a really helpful figure to see.
The bottom line is aldosterone is causing sodium to be
resorbed
in your blood.
And potassium secreted. Okay? And it, just by activating the sodium-potassium pump over here, but also by putting in these channels for sodium and potassium in the apical membrane. Okay? Okay. All right, so that's the aldosterone mechanism of action. Okay, so the macula densa, here's the macula densa right here. All right, it's in contact with the granular cells. Right, it acts as a sensor for tubular glomerular feedback needed for autoregulation of glomerular filtration. So that's going to regulate constriction or dilation of these vessels right here. Okay, so there are signals that affect the afferent arteriole to constrict. And it signals the granular cells to decrease secretion of renin when blood sodium is high. All right, so the juxtaglomerular apparatus is used for regulating glomerular filtration rate as well as sodium resorption. Okay, so here we have a table. Why do I have this table in here? All right, so regulation of renin and aldosterone. All right, so here we have a number of different stimuli. For instance, blood volume, decrease in blood volume, increase. All right, and if there's a decrease in blood volume, okay, renin secretion is increased. That's going to increase angiotensin II. That's going to increase aldosterone. All right, and low blood volume stimulates renal baroreceptors and the granular cells to release renin. So what's going to happen here? Sodium is going to be resorbed. That's going to increase blood volume. All right, but if the stimulus is an increased blood volume, that decreases renin secretion and then decreases aldosterone secretion, that increases blood volume, right? That inhibits the baroreceptors and that increases sodium in the distal tubule, right? So you're going to secrete sodium as a result of that. Okay, let's see, what else do I want to talk about this slide? Okay, sympathetic nerve activity. Okay, so that's going to increase renin secretion. Okay, increase aldosterone. But the alpha adrenergic effect stimulates constriction of the afferent arterioles. All right, so what might that effect be? If we constrict the afferent arterioles, what's the effect on urine formation then? Well, as the afferent arterioles constrict, that's going to decrease glomerular filtration, and that's going to decrease urine volume, right? So this is going to increase blood pressure. And there's even beta-adrenergic effects that stimulate renin secretion directly, which then increases blood pressure and sodium retention. All right, then I think maybe we just have one last thing to consider, but I think I've talked about this already. And that is atrial natriuretic hormone, right, is produced by the atria due to stretching of the walls of the atria. So when do the walls of the atria stretch? During diastole, when the heart fills. When does the heart fill? A lot. In regard to blood volume. When there's high blood volume, the atria stretch, right, and all right, so when they stretch, the atria release atrial natriuretic hormone. It's antagonistic to aldosterone and antidiuretic hormone. It's going to stimulate salt and water excretion in the kidney. All right, so it acts as an endogenous diuretic, not as an antidiuretic. So atrial natriuretic hormone, don't forget, is antagonistic to both ADH or vasopressin and aldosterone. Okay, and it causes excretion. But I won't give you the mechanism of how it works. Okay? All right, so that's it. Oh, I had a lot more time than I thought today. But I didn't have any questions regarding these figures right here. They're really helpful. They look complicated, but they're not really too bad.
They look very scary.
They look scary? Okay, look them over a couple times. Okay, so if you want me to go over them again, we got time. Okay, huh? All right, let's go back to antidiuretic hormone. Here's antidiuretic hormone. Don't forget, another name for antidiuretic hormone is vasopressin. Okay? And how does that get in the blood? Ooh, let's see if I can figure this out. How does vasopressin get in the blood? How does ADH get in the blood? Where does it come from? Ooh, let's go back. It comes from the posterior pituitary. What's controlling the posterior pituitary? The hypothalamus. And what's in the hypothalamus? Osmoreceptors. Right? And when do they get stimulated? When do their action potentials increase? When the blood becomes dilute or salty?
Salty.
When the osmolality goes up, the osmoreceptors release antidiuretic hormone. The bottom line is then you retain fluids and that decreases the osmolality of blood. Okay. All right, so the posterior pituitary is releasing antidiuretic hormone. That's a protein hormone, small protein hormone, can't get across the plasma membrane, so there's got to be a plasma membrane receptor. So it binds to the receptor, works through a second messenger. Have you heard of second messenger systems? Absolutely. Okay. Cyclic AMP, and that, of course, requires ATP to form cyclic AMP. This initiates a cascade of effects, which then inserts these aquaporin water pores, which are held in reserve in these vesicles that are called endosomes, right, into the apical surface of this membrane. So now water can diffuse into the cell. So without the insertion of these aquaporin membranes, this membrane is impermeable to water. Water can't get into the cell. It's only when there is an ADH signal that water can enter the cell. And it does because look at the concentration gradient. Right? It's high water here, low water here, and even lower water concentration inside the vasa recta. Right? So as long as water has a way to get through the cell, it will move by diffusion from high concentration to low. And it's manipulated by the salt. Now this happens in only the juxtamedullary nephron, only in the medullary nephrons, because that's where we find these high concentrations of salt. And we didn't have time to talk about the countercurrent mechanism, but maybe you ran into that in your textbook. So if you're really curious about that, you can go ahead and read about it, but that's not on the final as to why high salt concentrations are maintained in the medullary part, the deep parts of the kidney, right, just so that the system works. All right, so that's ADH. Works by inserting these aquaporin channels into this apical membrane right here.
So this is because the blood is
a
higher osmolality.
Yeah, blood osmolality increases in the brain.
ADH
okay.
Increases.
Then ADH is released from the posterior pituitary, and that signals the kidney to resorb water to dilute that salt out.
You're going
to
urinate less, and more water can go back in.
Okay, so you will urinate less volume, but more salt
right.
As a result of that. Mm-hmm. Okay? Yeah. So that's an antidiuretic, right? Urinate less. With more salt, antidiuretic hormone. All right, and then the other mechanism was aldosterone. All right, so aldosterone, you should remember, is what kind of hormone? It's a steroid, and the basic nature of steroids are? They're lipid, so they're hydrophobic. All right, so they can go right through the plasma membrane. So when aldosterone is released by the, should we go through the whole mechanism? Can you follow me? I can say it, but I don't know if you can visualize. What starts the release of aldosterone? It's going to be something released from the kidney, namely renin. All right, when blood pressure decreases, renin is released. Renin is an enzyme, not a hormone. So it's going to do what? It's going to increase the rate of some kind of chemical reaction. It's going to increase the rate of angiotensinogen converted into angiotensin 1, which has mediocre activity. it's going to be chopped. Two amino acids are going to be snipped off one end of angiotensin 1
by ACE,
which is mostly in the lungs. ACE is going to go to the adrenal cortex, going to stimulate the release of aldosterone, which takes us to this slide right here.
You skipped angiotensin 2.
By ACE. ACE makes angiotensin 2.
Then it goes to the adrenal cortex.
And angiotensin 2 goes to the adrenal cortex. Okay. Releases aldosterone. And then where does aldosterone find itself? In the, we don't have a picture. That's what? That's a kidney, right? That's a kidney. And mostly in the kidney, there might be some other tissues that have aldosterone receptors, but the kidney does in what? The distal parts of the nephron. It has what kind of receptors? They're not plasma membrane receptors. They are cytoplasmic receptors because aldosterone can get right in. And then this becomes a transcription factor, meaning that it can initiate transcription of particular genes. All right, so that makes messenger RNA, which then can be used by translation, can be used by ribosomes in the cytoplasm to make proteins that make new channels for potassium and sodium. All right, can make new proteins that will regulate, will open existing channels, number two, and it can make new proteins that act as sodium potassium pumps, ATP pumps, in the basal lateral membrane. All right, so how does this sodium potassium pump work over here? What's it going to do for potassium? Boot it out of the cell? What is it going to, no, sorry. It's going to get it to move into the cell, but it's going to boot sodium out. Okay, so it's going to help the secretion of potassium out of the body, but the resorption of sodium into the body because of that sodium-potassium pump, all as a result of this aldosterone signal here working as a transcription factor. So the body really didn't have to build much in the way of new machinery or apparatuses to adjust sodium and potassium. But bottom line is, you know, if you can't remember this in 5 years or 3 years from now, which way does sodium and potassium go because of aldosterone? Yeah, opposite ways, right? So it's going to be for sodium retention, but potassium secretion.
Okay. This whole thing to increase blood pressure.
This is basically to increase blood pressure, but also to increase sodium concentration. Or, right, if your body can cut back on an aldosterone signal when potassium is high. All right, so for whatever reason, if potassium high, that can be used to decrease potassium. Okay, but at the cost of resorbing sodium. That's the way aldosterone works. All right, so those are some really good slides. All right, so Wednesday, 3:30, I believe. Okay. Okay, I'll get busy. Yeah, well, you should see most of the questions. You should be familiar with most of the questions already. All right, any other questions? I guess I don't have anything else to say.